Tiny Talk, Episode 1. In this episode, introduction to the podcast, playgrounds, and a visit to Arabian Moons. Hi, and welcome to Tiny Talk, a podcast about mushes and other text-based virtual worlds. I'm your host, Javelin, and this is the first episode of a brand new podcast, so be gentle with it. As far as I know, this is the first podcast devoted to games in the Tiny Mud family, so mush and mucks and the like, and now you're in on the ground floor. My plan for the podcast is to produce a 15 to 25 minute show every few weeks with a set of segments that you'll get a mix of during each show, some thoughts of my own on mushing, an interview with someone doing something that's interesting and relevant to mushing, a visit to a mud where we'll kind of highlight some innovative things that are going on, questions and answers, and some news and notes. All right, so let's get on with the show. So I wanted to talk a bit about some of the things I noticed while I was watching my son playing at the playground near our house recently. It occurred to me that playground equipment falls into a number of kind of distinct categories that you can organize around how you interact with it and how many people get to play at once. So first, you know, you have the classic play structures with the ladders and the slides and bridges and poles and so forth. So, you know, what do we think about when we think about play structures? Well, you can have any number of kids. You can have one kid alone. And you can do any kind of activity you like on a play structure. It really goes better with imagination. So kids can work together. Kids can compete in various ways. As I said, a single kid can imagine that they're flying a spaceship or whatever they want to do. It's kind of like a sandbox in this respect. Most of the role-playing and social mushes that I've visited are basically play structures. I mean, they really do a good job of getting this right. The builders on the mush provide places to play, but it's really up to the players to decide what they're going to do with it, how they're going to work together. And a lot of these places work fine, whether it's one player or many players. It's really all down to the imagination. Then you've got things like seesaws. Right, so a seesaw is a piece of play equipment that only works with two people. And the two people have to cooperate to make it work. They've got to work together. So there are some games like this for adults, right? Particularly, there's a neat two-player tabletop role-playing game called Breaking the Ice by Emily Kerr Boss, in which the players role-play the first three dates of a new couple. You know, this is a game that only works right with two players, and it only works right if the players are cooperating and telling a story. There wouldn't be much point in running a mush for only two players, although it would be kind of interesting to run one where all of the important interactions were basically dyads. But there are certainly opportunities in mushes to develop activities or gimmicks that demand coordination between two or more players to function correctly. I mean, a simple example something like a heavy door, so only two players working together in some fashion can push it open. Adventure muds often do a good job of building challenges like this that require the diverse skills of a party of adventurers, and I'd like to see more of that in mushes. I'd like to see more opportunities for players to be required, really, to work together to achieve things. I think that's valuable in terms of teaching people how to play with one another, and that's kind of what it's all about. And then on the playground, of course, you have the swings. Swings are interesting, I think, because a swing is essentially a solo affair, but usually when you're learning how to use the swings, you need another person. So someone has to be there in the beginning to show you what's going on. It's all about mentorship and momentum, right? Finding someone to push you until you learn to get yourself started and keep yourself going. Those kind of principles, mentorship and momentum, apply to all sorts of mush activities. I mean, particularly, of course, learning activities. You know, when you learn how to build or code, in many cases, there's a real mentorship component to that on a lot of places. And then there's clearly a momentum component to that. Once you know how to do it, you know, you start swinging wider and wider, and soon you're psycho-coding, as they say, right? And of course, it's still really, in many ways, an individual activity, because coding in particular, we're not so good at dividing that up among a lot of people. Usually there needs to be some guiding vision to make things work in a reasonable fashion. But also there are role-playing activities, right? So where you have mushes that have feature characters or faction heads or things like that, sometimes those people really serve as a highly visible guidepost for new players. Their role is to orient the new players, that is mentorship, and to push them toward role-playing activities until they can finally get the players to be generating the activities for themselves, the momentum, and of course generating the activity for the other players. You get to that critical mass of players, and then all of a sudden they're driving the role-playing themselves. I'll say a little more about that later. In essence, play is really at the heart of what we do with mushes, as I mentioned earlier. And obviously, these are not the only models for play, right? Play structures and seesaws and swings. But I think it's important that we keep our eyes open and we keep looking around at models, particularly models outside of what's going on right now on our mushes, to find new ways to look at them and new ways to improve them. And if you would like to comment about these thoughts or anything else in this show, please feel free to do so. You can post responses to the show notes, which are on my blog at community.penmush.org. And at the end of the show, I'll tell you about several other ways that you could comment on it. This is going to be my first visit to a mush segment. And before I get into the visit itself, I want to give you a little information about what I'd like to do with this segment. My goal here is not so much to, advertise this is a really neat mush for you to go to, although I'd like to think that most of the places that I'm going to talk about are pretty neat mushes, but to really highlight what in each place that I visit I think they're doing that's both innovative and worthy of dissemination. That is, it's got to be something that's not so unique to the game that we couldn't use it elsewhere, that it couldn't become a model for what else is going on in the mush world, right? So you can think of these as sort of my idea of some best practices that I've seen by visiting other mushes. So today I want to talk about Arabian Moons, a role-playing mush that's just opened at the beginning of this month, March 2007, after a long playtesting period. They did that right. That was a kind of smart thing for them to do, so they've worked out a lot of kinks. And Arabian Moons is set in a world that's akin to the 1001 Arabian Nights. So if you've read Barry Hugart's novel Bridge of Birds, and if you haven't, you should, Bridge of Birds is a novel of an ancient China that never was. And that's basically what's going on at this mush. This is an ancient Arabia that never was, complete with magic and intrigue and some curious hints about something called clockwork technology that I haven't quite figured out. The staff is friendly and helpful, the role-playing is primarily player-driven, and interestingly, they seem to be rapidly gaining enough players to reach the critical mass that I think I talked about earlier that's necessary to make a player-driven setting work. They're going to have enough momentum in the players that they're going to be able to drive a lot of role-playing. Anyway, one of the innovative things that's going on at Arabian Moons is that they're using the fudge system, which I think many of us have heard of, but don't often see really implemented in mushes. I've always thought it's kind of well-suited to mushes that are looking for dice-based resolution mechanics, so a system for rolling dice to figure out who wins and who loses, as it were. Other Space New Journeys is another mush that also uses fudge. I had a project that's sort of become stalled called Archipelago that was also going to use fudge. So if it ever gets done, it will. If you're not familiar with it, fudge is the free, universal, do-it-yourself gaming engine. It is really free to use and to adapt. You can download all the rules online, and there's a huge community of people who've come up with variations and extensions and so on. So that's great, and there'll be a link to it in the show notes. What people first tend to notice about fudge, though, tends to be around the character generation. So the set of character traits, attributes and skills and the like, are not defined in fudge. They can be different for each milieu, each game. So Arabian Moons, for example, has a trait called chutzpah that's related to the ability to perform or resist magic. It's sort of like willpower, but you can call it whatever you want, so they've called it a chutzpah. They've got about 101 player skills that run the gamut from kind of combative to courtly. They're using rules for gifts and faults chosen by the player. and for a trait that they call wealth, which is assigned by the staff once the character is approved, once their background is approved by the staff. The next thing that people often notice about Fudge, once they start playing Fudge-based games, is that while underneath it there are numbers and, you know, the dice are really working in a numerical way, players normally deal with their stats, talk about them, and view them on their character sheet verbally. There are seven categories, usually, that run from terrible at the low end to super or superb at the high end. So you might be terrible or poor or mediocre or fair or good, great, or superb at something. And when you roll dice, they modify your traits when you're trying to do something. So you might try to do something that you're good at, and the dice cause your result to go up from good to great, or they drop it from good to mediocre. And what's really nice about that is it means that whenever players are trying to do something, whether it's just one player trying to do something or two players opposing each other, it's not a simple roll for success or failure. You have degrees of success, and we have this in a lot of different dice systems. You know, the World of Darkness has this as well. But, you know, Fudge does this in a really clean and simple way. One of my favorite podcasts, Paul Tevis's podcast, Have Games, Will Travel, recently talked about this. In fact, he was saying that one of the things that's nice is that when you have variable degrees of success and failure, you don't just get uncertainty, which you get whenever you roll the dice, but you have the opportunity to get the unexpected when someone has to interpret that roll of the dice. And I agree with him there. Another neat trick that they're playing at Arabian Moons is mush web integration. The in-game news files and the bulletin board, which is Myrdin's bulletin board, can also be read through the game's website, because they all share a common SQL database. And that idea, using an SQL database as a means of inter-process communication between a mush and some other information system, like a website, for example, is gaining a lot of momentum now, as SQL servers are becoming, you know, sort of regularly available to people on Linux boxes, and mushes of all server flavors are getting easy to configure for them. We're seeing a lot of that. So my prediction is that one of these days someone will get around to writing a sort of soft code library for doing these kind of interfaces with, you know, websites, with PHP Nuke, so forth, in an elegant and general way. Something sort of like PHP MyAdmin, if you're familiar with that, but in mush code. And once that object is written and those kind of functions are available, I think this is going to become a ubiquitous practice. Everywhere we're going to see mushes talking to other kinds of processes, notably web servers, but other kinds of processes using SQL as a common data store. So they don't really have to interact directly, they just get to share a big database. So that's my prediction, and if you want to write that soft code library, please let me know about it, and we'll talk about it here. So those are the two things I wanted to showcase from Arabian Moons, and it's a really neat place to play as well, so you'll find a link to it in the show notes. And now some news and notes from the Mush World. I have only one piece of news for now. It's sort of self-serving. My mush, which unfortunately has a sort of unpronounceable name, I just say it as mush, but of course, if you've been there, you know it's spelled like the TV show MASH, MUSH. Mush is having a teaching and learning festival in the month of April, and there have been a number of really interesting sessions announced. You can get a little abstract of each of them on community.penmush.org. I'm going to be giving a little presentation on how to write or adapt live-action role-playing games for use on mushes, which is lots of fun. There's going to be several presentations that really don't have that much to do with techie stuff, so if you're not into the techie stuff, that'll be fun too. In any case, a lot of stuff to check out there, and you know, read more at community.penmush.org or log in to mush.penmush.org, port 4201, or 4202 with SSL. I would be delighted, by the way, to receive news and notes from other mushes. I can't promise, of course, to read everything that I get on the show, but I do promise to look at everything. So if you have news and notes that you think is would be relevant to the mush community, please go ahead and send them to me. You can send them by email at tinytalk@javelin.penmush.org, or you can contact me in any of the other ways that we'll talk about in just a minute at the end of the show. And that about wraps it up for episode one of Tiny Talk. If you're downloading this directly from the web, you should hopefully also be able to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. You should be able to search for it in the iTunes store by name, Tiny Talk. And information about how to do that and other topics in this show will appear in the show notes, which are posted at community.penmush.org in Javelin's blog, and they'll probably appear on the front page there as well, but you can always look for my blog. If you have comments, mushing questions you'd like answered, suggestions for future shows, somebody you think would be really interesting to interview, whatever, you can send email to me, tinytalk@javelin.penmush.org, or you can leave a voicemail at 206-666-5114. That's 206-666-5114, as long as you don't mind having your voice played back on the show. You could also email me an audio file if you prefer. Music for this episode of Tiny Talk comes from Ska Station from the En Réalité album and Jamendo.com. Tiny Talk is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license. You're welcome to share it as is, just don't sell it. Until next time, keep the text flowing.